I'm not like them, but I can pretend. I think I'm dumb, maybe just happy. I think I'm dumb.
What up, homies and homos? This is Prayers. That's our new Jen. You're the second. You're the first guest, and the second time we've used our new opening line. What do you think?
I like it. I think it suits you. I mean, it is the gay guy and a straight guy podcast, so
famous.
You have to play to your
Jen
brand.
A homie or a homo?
We're not going to make him say that.
Well, we did establish you could be both. That someone could be both, yeah. Theoretically. So
I think I think that works. Yeah,
you have a little bit of like faggot voice, but I'm not going to make any assumptions based on that. And I don't know. I don't think you'll be offended if I say that.
No, I, you know, I have like people from Toronto will know I have like a Midtown Toronto accent, like not the Midtown that is now, but the Midtown of like my generation. And so we all have this Japish kind of schoolgirl, like Toronto has a really strong, private school.
Wait, can
culture.
You do the, can you wait? I didn't mean to interrupt you, but just really, I did mean to, but just really quick, very moisturized one time, did this really funny impression of that girl that's like, yo, you leave your moms in the hood. What is she? Have you seen that clip?
And yeah.
Like, you go smoke that ute.
So this is the truth, is that I did grow up with tons of West Indians, like tons. Like my whole friend group is like, but they're Asian West Indians, so I don't know if that counts or not. But I can do the accent, and I will try and like throw it in as a surprise, but I'll have to think about like what I'm gonna say.
Say you make me sick to my stomach, fam. Can you say that?
No, I can't. I'll cue. Let me process it in my brain. Like, get it. And then I will come out with something.
All right. I'm sorry. Better.
No, don't be sorry. It's just,
she
I
was
think
just
it'll
trying
be
to
more...
get you on tape doing an offensive accent.
Oh, I don't mind. I don't mind doing it.
Racket.
Well, you know, I recorded with Datman and I was like joking. We did, our topic was Jamaica. So every, like I had to pronounce all these words and I was like, should I do it? Or is this going to be like so offensive if I do? Because I can actually do it rather well, like to be honest. But I was like, I can think in that voice. Like I can hear people that I know speak like that. So I can just think like that. But for me, like I have just that like jappy Midtown Toronto. Like people from Toronto will understand, will know exactly what I'm talking about. We have that way of speaking. I don't know.
So you're saying all of Toronto has gay voice?
No, but I'm saying that there's a specific kind of like private school accent that is very common in like a certain Midtown area.
Okay. Well, that was a funny intro. We have the ninja on with us. He is that what you like to be called, Jin? I'm forgetting from our podcast when I recorded with you if I did Jin. Is that right?
Yeah, Jin. That's my, you know, that's my real name.
Oh, okay. Oh cool. All
I
right.
Was telling my wife about you, about our guest today, and she kept thinking I was saying Jim the ninja.
Well, go ahead and like shout out all your stuff, Jen, because we do that at the top. So
okay, that sounds good. Well, I have a show. It's called Threshold Saints. Q was on it. We did an episode, a great episode on the craft and like a decode of that. And we did a little Kabbalah because that's sort of what I can do rather well. And yeah, I kind of like probably took him to a little bit of a esoteric place, but I think that we, you know, I think it was a really good episode. It was really strong and I'm really proud of it, so everybody should go check that out.
I have so much fun. Sorry, I'm eating, but I did want to ask you about something that Pool House mentioned today that you might want to tell me about. Which had to do with our episode, so this is not a total non sequitur. But he told me to ask you about the Saint Loyola prayer.
Oh, the meditations?
Yeah. What is he talking about? Because He said to me this morning that he thinks that in a year I have the potential to be one of the greatest Christian of my day.
So he actually did tell me this in DM.
What's the St. Loyola prayer?
Well, it's not a prayer. It's a series of meditate. It's called the spiritual exercises is what it's called. And they're very difficult. Like I've done them before. Okay. So when back in my like 20s, when I was like a ute, I used to do a lot more like magician shit. So they're a really important practice. You can do them with the rosary. You don't have to, but I did. And you do it as a preparation to do your like holy guardian angel ritual. It's like an invocation to meet your personal guardian angel, basically. There's actually a Scottish movie about it. I forgot the name of it, but it's quite good and it's quite accurate to how like you would do the thing. Like it's basically you go vegetarian for a year and a day. You can't have sex. Can't watch porn. There's a lot of restrictions. It's like tons of restrictions. You can only.
I'm already getting nervous right at the top about a few of these.
Okay, I know. But anyways, you can still do them. It's just that it'll take you longer. It just will be a longer process than a year in like a day. But that's just, it's like an 11, right? Like a year in a day. That's kind of the idea, even though that's 366 days, obviously. But the idea is like it's an 11 because it's a year in a day. Anyways, no, it's just, it's a series of spiritual exercises and like meditations on grace and like the passions and Mary and all different things, just different things. It's Christian Kabbalah, basically. It's like, I don't know if you know who Pico della Mirandola is, Q, but
I don't. I'm not as, I mean, actually I was proud because multiple people DM'd me and said I sounded smart about religion on your episode, which I appreciated. And by multiple
you did people, you sounded very erudite.
I basically mean like Pool House, but I don't feel as well read as some of you guys who are like deep in this stuff. So
wait, but Jen, so you buried the lead here. Did I'm you sorry. Get to meet your guardian angel?
No. Okay, so this is what it is. So if I had, let's just say I completed it. Okay, let's say hypothetically,
so you didn't
if I completed it, okay. I could not refer to it really.
However,
now that I am like a full-time Buddhist, I can say that I have had much more profound and interesting magical experiences in my current like religious framework than I had before. So even though I wanted them more before, I have them more now.
Interesting. I feel we've got Jen the Ninja with us today. I'm excited to have you on the show. I feel like your name is very fitting. I feel that you do, in a sense, have the spirit of a warrior, but in a sort of you know, agile and subtle warrior, perhaps. But well, I see you out on the timeline, you know. So I don't know. I mean, we do have a little agenda that we wanted to get to today with you. But I feel like personally, I'm just interested in, and we like to get this with our guests, is like just kind of your background. Like, how did you find yourself on this corner of Twitter, or like, you know, how did you get to be Jin the Ninja?
Yeah, and you're more on, I would say, more than like right wing Twitter, you're more on esoteric Twitter. I like having guests like you, because it's, you know, yeah, I want to hear how you got there.
But you did, you mention all the time too that you are like very opposed to like the leftist agenda and stuff like that too.
I mean, after 20, well, it was earlier for me, and we can actually get into that. I've never really told that story, but so Twitter wise, I had an account, rather large, not huge or anything. Like, actually, my account's bigger now. So. Okay. But it was like 12. I had like a 1,200 people prior, and so it got totally nuked during the trucker shit. That's basically what happened. And like a lot of people just totally
like Twitter took it down.
Yeah. Like, and I could not open a new account. Like,
cause totally. What were you like just posting about in support of the truckers?
Yeah. And then like, I had never really had like not really even in support of, just, I couldn't believe everything that had was going on. Like everything that we were watching, like in real time in Ottawa, like what the fuck was going on? Like, and the way that people like that were supposedly pro working class and like socialist or whatever, or even NDP, which is like the sort of socialist party here, like the way they were acting and speaking and like the things that they were saying were so horrendous. I mean, you couldn't clap, and I'm not really a clap. Like, people might know me now because I do like get into little quote tweet arguments or whatever, but the things that they were saying, it was almost like, it was very scary. Actually, I wasn't scared, but it was like what the fuck is going on? So that's more what happened. So then I got nuked. Then I had I have a still friends with her. She has a podcast. She invited me on. I was like, no, I can't never do that. And then she kept pressuring me, and I was like, okay, I'll go on one time. And right when she asked me to go on, someone else from Esoteric Twitter asked me to go on their podcast. And that turned into an 11-part series on Tantra and like this grouping of goddesses called the Mahavidya, Greater Wisdom. And I compared it with the 11 spheres of the Sephirah of the Kabbalah tree, basically. So I did this like long 33-hour, he made it like that, but 33-hour series on this thing. Then I started getting asked on other shows. And then I was like, fuck, I really need to have some kind of social presence so I can, you know, like plug my shit. Cause like, I'm not averse to that. Like I like doing it, to be honest. So I was like, I need to have some kind of presence just to like make sure I do it. So basically that's what happened. And so I just started it was like, that's why it's Wukong Reborn. It's the Monkey King Reborn. Cause the account is literally reborn. So basically that is my story. But I had followed Basil specifically. It was Basil and Amy Therese. I had followed them since like 2020 or 2021 or whatever. Like I had been aware of them more than anyone else in like the so-called right-wing sphere. I knew who Amy was because I had heard her on leftist podcasts, and she actually had done a really interesting podcast called on Red Scare Radio, or not Red Scare Radio. I'm sorry. Red Star Radio. Obviously I have like a discourse brain. So Red Star Radio, and it was like this based Marxist podcast. And I was never a Marxist, and I never like identified with their politics, but they were doing like very anti-lockdown stuff. And there was not very many people in Canada doing like actively anti-lockdown, anti-mandate, pro-trucker sort of work. And so obviously I listened to them because like you know, we all realigned and we all were like putting our differences aside to like figure out, like, you were like, who is on my team? Because it felt like nobody at first. So then you sort of slowly make connections and others. Anyway, so I listened to them and I was like, okay, like I can get down with like these takes, and like I didn't find their politics like odious or anything. So that's basically where it was. And then Basil's takes, like, obviously he's an original, he's an originator, you know, props to him. But I had, and I'm not trying to big up myself, but because of my background, I had developed some maybe proto formations of the TQ take, definitely the race stuff. I was already well on my way to like sort of where he is now. I was already on my way to there since 2016. Specifically,
I don't think he would like, you know, he always says, I'm not the first to say it, but you're talking about it now because of me.
100%. And I give total props to him.
I think that's a healthy and valid way to look at what he's done to the discourse. So,
no, I agree. And Basil knows, like, Basil's going to come on my show. And I love Basil, like, not love Basil, but I really respect him greatly. And I agree with him like 99% of the time. obviously there's the one issue that I don't is a little off color, and I'm a little more conservative. That's just the truth. I just am a little more conservative in that way. And
oh, what's the issue you don't agree with him on?
It's not that I don't agree, but like the when he talks about like sex stuff or like the, you know what I'm talking about, Q. I'm not gonna say it. Like where he goes, like, you know.
Like the BWC. And
Exactly. Yeah,
I understand. Yeah, him and I, he knows I'm prudish about stuff like that too.
Yeah, I'm just a little more, I'm just a little more private. And it just like, so my family's quite conservative. I don't speak like that in my like regular life. So it would be even hard for me to speak like that online, just to be honest. So
yeah, the deeper I've gotten into my, I've always been Catholic. I'm a cradle Catholic. But the deeper I've gotten into rediscovering it, the more and more I've been trying to do a lot less smut on the timeline. Although I did just start an alt that's like kind of all pictures of nude women. So.
Well, but that's okay. That's okay.
I feel like it's different because I got a little bit inspired by friend of the pod Fitz because he was talking on Basil's pod about how porn is so ugly, but like these photographers who do this like high end kind of erotic photography,
tasteful nudes.
Yeah. They're, but like not even, it's even above tasteful nudes. It's like they're creating high art. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like me, nudity in high art is very different than nudity in pornography. I think
it's, no, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. I'm not like a prude in that way. Like, and I was thinking of Fitz when you were saying like you started the alt, I was like, oh, Fitz always posts like beautiful, like photography nudes, and like sometimes it is nude women, and that doesn't bother me at all. Like it doesn't bother me in any capacity now. And I've even seen Poolhouse's butt, and not in a weird way because he posted on the timeline. So I'm just saying, you know, like it's not like I make a judgment. It's just that I just don't refer to those things in life. So for me,
no, I mean, I totally get it. I mean, as someone in a long, I mean, both A and I are in like super long-term relationships. He's married because he's straight. I'm not married because I don't believe in gay marriage, but I am in a long-term monogamous relationship. And I don't feel comfortable sharing anything about like any details about my sex life on Twitter at all.
Yeah, that's really it.
I think that's like, you know, I think that's uncouth when you're in love and you're, you know, very close with someone. You don't want to, you know, yeah.
No, I see, that's where I am. I mean, I'm not in a relationship, but I'm just like, that's just like private. That's between like you and whomever. That's not, you know, I don't share that stuff, but that's just me, right?
I'm
not
making a judgment. You wouldn't walk the streets of London wearing a I Heart BWC t-shirt.
Well, that was funny, and like obviously I do have an edgelord sense of humor in some things. People, I can't run away from it, really. Obviously on Twitter people will know, so I think that that's funny. I think that's provocative in the right way, so I don't have a problem. I thought that was a great move, great for his brand. And I think
the problem is, and like now we're just kind of like riffing here, but I think the which is fine. But I think the problem is that like there's kind of like the Lena Dunnification of the millennial generation, where it was like, oh, you're supposed to just like talk about like all your embarrassing sex stuff, like everything you do, all the weird fetish stuff. Like you're supposed to just like be like totally open about it. And it was like a complete like 180 from how it was maybe 30 years ago. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where it was like, and I think that like, there's got to be a middle ground. Like there's got to be like something in between. Like I have to write a think piece about the time my boyfriend tried to have anal sex with me, and like sex isn't mentioned at all. I just got to believe there's a there's a middle.
You know, there's this thing. I just like, I like the idea. You know, Basil, I don't like Foucault, and I'm not counter signaling Basil, but he likes Foucault because Foucault does talk about like the private and public. And like in when I was like even in undergrad, but like way beyond undergrad, they would always, whenever I would take like pre-modern history classes, they would always make us read Foucault on biopower. And it was always in interesting circumstances because it would always be like Japanese pre-modern history, like the woman hides behind the sort of like the sliding door, and she doesn't take like regular visitors. Like people can't physically see her. She would always be partitioned if she was like of a higher class. So I like this idea of to distinguish public and private. And I think that that's actually like useful.
Yeah, but I don't care about that brown rapist, so.
I agree. I totally agree, Q. I totally agree, but I was just saying as a preface, like.
No, I know what you were saying. I know what you were saying. I just wanted to call Foucault a brown pedophile rapist.
He was raping gross. I mean,
Algerian boys on
Tuesday. I mean, no, horrible. That's something, it's not really recoverable as like a thing, in my opinion. That's just my opinion.
So Jin, so I just want to get your kind of origin story here. So it sounds like COVID was a pivot moment for you, as it was for all, you know, Q and myself. So but where were you at kind of politically before that? Sounds like you may have been already from a more conservative bent even at that point.
This is the thing. I thought of myself as being like a left libertarian, kind of like I thought I was like in that circle. Like I thought I was like one of those people. Mm-hmm. But then, well, even this was even a thing when I was an undergrad, people used to say, "You're so conservative," like to me all the time, honestly. And I'm really not conservative. Like I'm really not. I have tattoos. I've lived my wild life. I've had relationships. It's not like I'm like a saint. Okay. So I'm not saying this in any kind of like self-aggrandizing or on a horse or anything kind of way. People have always noted how conservative I am, and maybe it's more that I'm reserved. I think that's maybe perhaps what it is. So, but I thought of myself like the kind of that label that we put on ourselves and the things that we think we are, and we aren't necessarily like embodying those things perfectly in the world. But I thought I was. So there was like this, we had a pre-BLM thing in Canada. It was called Idle No More. And it was like, it was for First Nations and Indigenous people.
Oh, Lord.
And yeah, it was as bad as it sounds. But, you know, I thought this is like it. This is like liberatory movement. I was like, this was way back in like 2011. And so I just was like, but then I started to see some of the really the logical flaws and just the arguments were circular. They didn't have a conclusion that really made sense. Like, and I took some of those classes in university. So it was like I read like the five stages of decolonization. Okay. So like, and this was written in like the 90s. So there was clearly like this epistemology of this decolonization theory that was happening that wasn't African American and wasn't Palestinian. It was like totally indigenous, totally native. So, but then you have to like kind of figure out, where is this coming from? Who's like introducing it? Like, this is not something that people are just self-arriving at. So when I started like thinking more, reading more, understanding more, you kind of realize that this is like all sort of manufactured. So, like the left has a lot of like what the left accuses the right of all the time, like being like Koch brothers or like this secret globalist fascism to, you know, put the bussy sellers in gulags or whatever. That is the left too. So that's kind of what I always realized, but I always was critical of both state and capital. So that was my kind of my saving grace, is that I never was like, I'm never going to be team either one. So when people started like, when they were giving out like the money and stuff here, I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, these were people who were saying they were like down anarchists and like, you know, we're like, you know, they were like, they would just thought they were so punk rock and like talking about like how to score drugs during the lockdowns and stuff. And I'm like, you love this. Like, you're getting like free money. You're just like, so like, this is like your wet dream. Like, how are you down? And so I just realized that everything that they perform, everything they say is really a lie. It's just like a total bullshit lie. It's like completely insincere. It's completely to get like six-figure jobs doing management consulting, or like what is very popular here is that they will often become like university professors. We've got quite a few people, and all universities are public in Canada. So it's really interesting when you have these, like, especially women, Native women will become professors and be like, we hate capitalism. We hate colonialism. We need to retake over the institution. And then they all have white husbands too. So that's always really interesting. And then, but then you're like, you get paid, like you're making like $300,000 a year or more at public institutions, and you're calling for literally the downfall of those same institutions. I just think that that is really problematic. I think it's really illogical, and I think it's really insincere. And it just, none of their critiques made sense. They were always like, one thing I always knew growing up was that like all the First Nations people I ever known my whole life were very conservative. Very conservative, very Catholic, and people have a big problem with that. And they would always re-narrativize sort of that history of being like, oh, Catholicism was like forced on us. Like, I know a lot of Native people that go to church like every Sunday, that are extremely devout, that they have their own Marian kind of like apparitions, their own relationship with things. And yes, we did have residential schools and whatever that was. But the reality was, is like only a third of them were run by the church. The other one third of them were run by Anglicans and Methodists and Baptists and what we call United Church of Canada. And then another third were run by the government. So you can't really just blame Catholics. It's just totally, that's totally insincere. But that does seem to happen a lot. So I could just see that they kind of like were retelling their whole story and saying like, you know, in the trans stuff, that really started way earlier here. Like way earlier, was happening in like 2008. Like I knew people who were Native, who were transitioning, who would say, oh, we're two-spirited. And what does that even mean? That was like a term invented in 1989. So I just think there was obviously some kind of like insidious, I don't know. Like it was clearly like it was like globalism. Like there's no other real, like there's no other, I don't have any other vocabulary word to use to describe it. It was like this like insidious force that they were trying on this sort of like down and out community who has a lot of their problems are self-originating, but some of them aren't. Some of them are structural, but they were clearly like in like a vulnerability. They were vulnerable. So they were like pushing these kinds of ideas onto them as like a test ground. And I could see it, and I could see it happening. And then Trump got elected, and it people's like rhetoric became so much more hysterical. And there is this Canadian tendency to be very like, I hate Americans. They're so bad. They're so backwards or this. And I'm like, you've never lived there. You don't know any Americans. They don't affect your life. Like, and I mean, in a real way, I'm not talking like in the greater scope of politics, but they don't really affect their lives. And these are all like urban liberals who are just like smug as fuck and like, you know, just very punchable. So the reality is like, I just found it all insincere. And I just was like, this is all fake. So like, let's cut through the bullshit. Let's cut through all this like fake, like, Fabian socialist academic sort of like epistemologies and like these crazy like culture creation mechanisms. Let's cut through it all, and I want to see what there is, and like, who am I beyond like all of this identity, beyond all this rhetoric, and just like figure out what that is. So obviously I was like drawn to more of a libertarian, sort of more of that American style libertarianism, because it made sense at that time, especially in 2020, especially during lockdowns, especially with mandates. So, I mean, that's basically where I started from. And then I was like, okay, like, can I build onto this critique? And what are some like valid criticisms of libertarianism that I could start to apply and see, like, there was a lot of things libertarians were saying that I didn't agree with, but I was like, why am I not agreeing? Like, why is it not clicking for me? I should be able to fit in a box. And then I realized I actually don't need to fit into any box. I can be heterodox. I can be you know, I can really think for myself, and I have always been able to do that. So I just was like, I'm going to do that. And some things I'm going to agree on and some things I'm not going to agree on. But I want to know, like, I want to know the origins of things. I want to know where, like, these ideas are coming from. I don't just like being in the unknown of it. Like, I don't want to agree with something if I haven't explored it fully. That's why I don't, I often will reserve my political takes on Twitter, because, you know, sometimes I'm not sure and I want to see how I feel about it in like a week, or I just want to see how I feel about it in a few days, or I want to like research something and then come to my own, like kind of like arrive at something that I think is a more informed opinion.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's wise. And I think, you know, I mean, I think it's okay to like kind of, if you're so inclined to post like, oh, like it seems like this could be happening, or kind of a speculation or a initial take or whatever. But it does seem like a lot of times in the discourse, just the way it's structured, there is sort of a pressure to like, everyone has to like have their take, you know, ready to go right away as soon as there's a new thing. But
well, I mean, a lot of that is just monetization, right? Like, if you don't strike while the iron's hot, you're not going to get your check. So it's like, which is funny because like almost everyone I know is getting like $36 checks. So we're not talking like big money here. But, you know, like I feel like people feel this pressure to immediately, yeah, like jump into the discourse. And like one thing I've appreciated on our pod from A in particular is like sometimes more than me, A will just be like, I don't know, like I'm not 100% decided on this issue. And I think it's good sometimes to admit that like you're not, you know, like it's complicated and there isn't necessarily like a one way or the other way of looking at, you know, every single issue.
I agree with that. I think you, sorry, A, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say I have always appreciated that about A myself. And I also think that that's a healthier way to be. And I think that not like being so, like being in control of your feelings, like, yes, social media is designed to provoke a reaction. Yes. But maybe the wiser thing is to be more reserved in your sort of opinion until you feel like you can develop it further.
Yeah. And there's things I think we like do, like we can say like definitively, like I think everyone on our side of Twitter agrees that like men cannot become women. Like I don't have a very like nuanced take on that.
No.
Like, but there's plenty of things that I do have nuanced takes on, and that's, you know, I think it's worth, I think it's worth admitting that. And even though I agree that men can't become women, I do have some nuanced takes on like how we handle that phenomenon, you know? And so even within the agreeing on this one part of it, I also like think there is some debate on how to handle like what exactly is going on, you know. Wait, A, did you have more serious questions? Because I wanted to bring up both the serial killer and something horrible I saw on Twitter. But if you have more, like...
Well, I was just going to ask, just, and then I do want to get into what we brought Jin on to talk about. I just wanted to ask, so, about your initial reaction to COVID. Like, when that happened, they announced this virus, we need to lock down, whatever, 15 minutes to slow the spread. Like, what did you think at that time? Like, what was your just initial reaction?
I was like, this is bullshit. I could feel that they were ramping it up. I could see it happening. They started giving the numbers in January. They were like, oh, there's one in Toronto. Then it was like, slow.
Wait, can I like challenge you for a minute? Like, sure. No cap. You weren't scared at all. You totally thought it was bullshit from the beginning.
I really did. I'm not trying to be like,
I mean, like, valid. I that was not my
experience. What did you think it was? Like, did you just think it was like media hysteria, or did you get that there? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you have to remember though that like I am from Toronto and I have Asian, like an Asian parent and Asian grandparents, and I lived through SARS. So I already had this experience. Like it was like that summer. It was like that. I just everything about it. it just brought back all the memories of that. And I was like, wasn't that old when SARS happened. I would have been like 13. I would have been like 13, 2001, 2002, mm-hmm. 13, 14. So yeah, I think that.
So what happened back then? Because my memory of it, I mean, I remember that happening and them like talking about it on the news, but it never like seemed to really amount to anything from my perspective. Like it didn't really like have any tangible impact on my life other than like seeing it on the news.
So at that time, you have to remember Toronto was almost a third Chinese at that time.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And
I didn't know
everybody,
that.
So everybody has this deep connection to like, it was in that time, it was mostly Hong Kong, but there were starting to be mainlanders coming in. So there was like just this, everybody really, and it was a big deal in Hong Kong, right? It was like a huge deal. Like people, it was, they didn't lock down, but everybody was wearing masks. And that's really when the mask thing started. And so maybe that is why now that I'm kind of like retelling the story, I'm like thinking maybe that is why more than, I mean, of course, I want to say, yes, I'm just so discerning and wise that I saw through it. But I actually don't think that that is true. I think it is what you're saying, A and Q. I think that it is. I saw it from like that time. And then maybe I was like something in my mind was like very distrustful. But I was very distrustful of all these state narratives before. Like I had problems with how they had narrated so many things, so many different things. Like one major example was the constant discussion of residential schools. And so there was a residential school sort of like, it was called the Commission, Royal Aboriginal Commission, that happened in 1995. Okay. So they basically came out with this like huge report. They spoke with like thousands of people who survived them and like lived through the residential schools and the industrial schools and all of that. And so they kept kind of like bringing it up. They kind of like kept this, they kind of like were like, we need to do another commission. We need to do one in 2003. Then we need to do one in 2014. And it was like, they weren't really doing new material. It was like all recycled stories. It was all recycled narratives. And I was like, we've already gone over this. Like, why are we doing this? Like, 500 other times. Like, it doesn't really make sense. And because there would be a huge frenzy for months and they would run the headlines like genocide. And I'm not saying it wasn't, but I'm just saying that, you know, once you kind of like unpack something culturally, I think you can also put it to bed in the best, like, you know, you have to like move forward in a way. You can't just stay stuck in it. So I wondered, why are they kind of re-traumatizing us? But that's just one example. There was multiple examples, but I always had a really strong criticism of state media. So I'll say that. So I think that when I kept seeing them do it with the COVID thing, and then they were doing magic numbers, I saw that right away. And like the dates were magic.
The death ticker.
Yes, exactly. And you know, because it went from like, oh, there's 3 in the hospital, there's 8 in the hospital. And it was just like, it was just very strange. I just was like, this is really weird. Something doesn't feel right. They're going to lock down. I knew in January, I was like, this is not the norm. This is something different. This is something new. And I also think it was the astrological alignment. I really do. And I said this on another interview, but I really do believe that the 2020 moment was like a very difficult and interesting astrological alignment. And I think that all of us who saw through, whether we, how much we believed of it initially or not, I think that those of us who came out the other end believe it, like sort of being highly critical, being having like a more dissident TM opinions about things, or like even coming away from the left, or all of the things, like all the coalition that happened afterwards. I think we all went through a magical experience. It's kind of my thesis right now that I'm kind of, I don't know, refining. So yeah, that's what I think.
Well, cool. So, I mean, yeah, I know. I mean, super interesting story. And I love, I don't know, this is just a fascination for me. I love to see like just how everybody got to their little wake up moment or series of moments or whatever it was. So, and everyone has a different story. So it's super interesting, but
how we all came out.
Yeah.
We
all came out of our as Nazis. Yeah.
So yeah, like, well, yeah, Q, you take us into the,
well, I wanted to transition to the serial killer stuff, but I wanted to just say something horrific that was sent to my DMs like an hour ago.
Oh,
and I'm not sure if you guys saw it, but it's about to be all over Twitter, and it's an old man. He's like probably 70, and I guess he got the fake vagina surgery, and he's holding his castrated balls in his hands.
Oh my god.
So I just wanted to give a warning to both of you, and by the time people hear this, it's going to be too late, but just turn off that immediate, like, turn off autoplay, because it's, I saw it and I can't unsee it. So
wow.
I just thought that should be mentioned. But yeah, I want to talk about serial killers. So you brought us, you wanted to bring us a specific serial killer, Toronto area serial killer, and I was hoping you could give the listeners sort of a background on why it's interesting to you and how it connects to this other thing you wanted to talk about, and just kind of give us a spiel before we dive into, like, my own, like, all of our, well, A is less fascinated than I am, but my own fascination with serial killers and what I think they are and why I think they've essentially disappeared. So I don't know if you minded giving us a quick rundown of the specific serial killer you wanted to talk about.
No, not at all. I don't mind. So Toronto actually has been a place where there's been many serial killers, surprisingly, and like it's very little known, I guess. But we had a really big one that got arrested right before, really interestingly, right before lockdowns happened, I believe. So he got arrested. He had been sort of active for, they said, since the late 90s. So his name's Bruce MacArthur. He was called the Grinder serial killer or the Scruff serial killer. They had different names for him. They never really came up with like a really catchy one. But he targeted mostly Muslim and Sri Lankan men. So that's also very interesting. And there was several other murders that happened right before lockdown in the Village area. And the Village area is not like, I never hung out there or anything, but there, it was like very at, like, in my youth, people would like go there. It wasn't just like gay people. It was like, kind of like you could get in places easier. Like there was this lesbian bar that everybody would go to when I was in university. It was just like a kind of like a fun, easy place. It was not like going to Queen Street or King Street and going like to one of those clubs where it's like crazy and like that. It wasn't like that. It was like a lot of like Jamaican women, and then they had this club and they would play like reggae and like dance hall, and you know, like I joked about this, but I can't remember on which episode, but all Torontonians are spiritually West Indian in some ways. So we all we have this like reference of dance hall music. We have this reference of sort of like this Jamaican or Trinidadian culture. So that was the kind of the vibe. And it was just like an easy place to hang out in, especially when you're like a broke student, right? So anyways, he had been active throughout this whole time. People had been talking about it. People that I knew were saying, like, you know, there are some bad actors like that hang around here. You got to be really careful. I never really worried about it because I was never like in a scene or anything. So, but I thought it was really fascinating that like all these men like just disappeared. A lot of them were on refugee status. A lot of them were asylum claimants. And a lot of them were they were underground because their asylum claims had been denied, which is interesting because if you were on like underground, would you really go on like Grindr? Like, I don't know, but it's an interesting, I don't know. It's an interesting proposition. And because we know how serial killers are so connected to the deep state, if we want to use that kind of phrasing, and just like MK Ultra, and you know, Toronto is a site of that. I mean, that is part of the story of MK Ultra. It was developed at McGill in Montreal, but there was also another side where it was developed in partly at University of Toronto, which is where Harley Pasternak went, the famous Kanye trainer. And you know, there are rumors of underground tunnels between the women's college at U of T, and U of T is right there. U of T is very close to the village. U of T is also very close to the Scientology Center, which is like a multi-million dollar building, but it's like falling down basically. It has like all these windows blown out. It's a very weird place. And then the Process Church. So I was on a live stream with Dana, Rhoda Jules, who does all the stuff on the Process Church. And she was discussing like, she's sort of been looking at Toronto as the site of where they were doing the satanic sort of Process Church stuff. And it was there, and there was a temple on Yonge Street, and it's just like 3 or 4 blocks south of the Scientology building. So and then there's also this other famous murder that happened in 1977, which is where a illiterate Portuguese shoeshine boy had gone to work in, I guess some guy lured him into like a adult cinema, and they like kept him there and for several days and abused him, and then they drowned him. And this all took place, again, within like a block of where the Process Church temple was. And so I just think, and she also thinks, that there's like a much deeper connection to sort of these ongoing things. And I'm not making a judgment about the village or gay people in general, but I'm just saying that there are connections to this. And when we look at the Process Church in general, they do tend to set up shop in these kinds of like sleazy or sleaze adjacent communities. And I just think that that is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I heard about this case before you presented it to us. I didn't know the connection with the shoe shine.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have the connection with the shoe shine murder, but I do think that it sets a precedent for these kind of like underground murders that take place in this very small area of Yonge, which is the longest street in the world, as they say, maybe. And so I just think that it's strange that all this stuff takes place within like a 6 block radius of each other.
Well, I think there's a few things that are interesting about it, because so there's a few groups that like serial killers target, right? And it's like typically, okay, there's one group, prostitutes. There's another group, it's gay, you know, homosexual men, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's people who tended to be on like the margins of society for like whatever reason. And it's interesting when you think about like identity formation, because like the left is obsessed with creating sort of like making having sex with men into a specific like political identity, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, and you know, people might say there's flaws in my argument, which is fine, but I'm just going to go with it just as a thought experiment. By making it a political identity, you then give like this group of people power to sort of have a literal physical community. They have land, right? Mm-hmm. But then it's like once they have this like kind of region of a city, if you're going to like do a government like sort of op, or you're going to do an MK Ultra sort of thing, you've created kind of like the perfect breeding ground to like operate within, because yes, you're going to be dealing with people who probably to some extent are secretive about their sexual lifestyles. Mm-hmm. We know that like, you know, like prostitutes, gay men, people who like have deviant sexual lifestyles don't always discuss that or talk about that with their families. So it's almost like by creating this like kind of identity politics thing, the government kind of ends up creating these little like perfect little labs where these serial killers can operate, you know, like within the confines of this little like lab rat area almost, you know, and they can get away with it for a long time because particularly with the Toronto homicides, what was his name? I'm blanking on his name right now. Bruce MacArthur. It's like no one knew who these like random Sri Lankan and Afghani like illegal immigrants were, right? Mm-hmm, so whatever the purpose of Bruce MacArthur was, it's like he could operate for a long time undetected. Mm-hmm. And I think that like liberal or like whatever, more lefty people would say like, oh, like because these people were oppressed, they were just like easier targets. And therefore, that's why they were getting killed. But I would actually argue that, like, in some ways, leftist politics create the material conditions that allow for these kind of, like, off-the-grid places where the government can do these experiments, which are basically just, how far can you push a person to kill, like, to create terror or whatever, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
No.
So, I don't know. That's, like, a theory that I've had percolating in my head, especially talking with Basil about how, like, you know, gay identity is sort of, like, this kind of false formation because it, I do think it creates these kind of, like, it creates a perfect group to experiment on in a lot of ways. It creates a perfect group to experiment on pharmacologically. Mm-hmm. It creates perfect group to experiment on with things like MK Ultra, and it creates a perfect group to sort of use for the military industrial complex to justify foreign wars. So there's a big incentive to kind of create this this new category of people who maybe and definitely historically didn't always think of themselves as a cohesive community or category of people.
That was really well said, Q. Honestly, you said everything that I was trying to say and trying to like encapsulate when I introduced like the serial killer and the subject. But I will also add that he was well known to be like he was not welcome at any place within like the confines of Church Street, as it was like retold by several people. They interviewed like one of the owners of Woody's, which is a very famous bar. And they said that he had been banned since like 2001. So, I mean, I'm not saying he was banned everywhere, but that's a pretty like hub spot if you know like the area. So I think that people knew that there was something off about him, that there was something devious, and that
but this is but just to quickly interrupt, like this is like repeated like endlessly, like Dahmer
100%, was 100%.
Dahmer was banned from the bathhouses at some yes. point, right? But it didn't stop him from and I think because it's like he wasn't meant to stop, right? Like mm-hmm. whoever
that's exactly yeah, right
whoever his handlers were, we're going to keep giving him, you know, people to kind of enact these experiments on.
No, you're 100% correct. And I agree with that. And I that's what I'm trying to allude to, is I think he was allowed to act with a kind of impunity. If you like, because I watched it like unfolding on the news as much as I watched the news, and but it was very interesting. I found it very captivating in some ways, because he was supposedly like a landscape architect, and he buried all these bodies at different people's houses, in garden beds, in sheds that he had access to. It was like very strange. It was not like a coherent. It felt more less serial killer and more hitman almost. Like it felt like there was this element of like not even being cautious, not even being like careful. Like maybe, like, I think that you're right, Q. I think that it definitely was much more of a operation than.
Yeah. And one thing that I don't want to get too dark, but like one thing that I want to bring up is like, you know, there's like the Golden State Killer and people like that, where the MO was, he would come into the home, tie up the man and rape the woman, which is like a horrific thing to even like fathom. But, you know, in some of these cases, if you read about it, some of these men who were also victims, I would argue, in these situations, 100%. Ended up becoming gay or engaging in homosexual acts, like the marriage broke apart and that's where they ended up. And I'm like, I've always thought about that. I'm like, was that a sick fucking twisted thing? You know, yeah, what I mean? Like, to like cause this like such a horrifically traumatic event in these people's lives that not only does the marriage break apart, but the man ends up kind of having a deviant like sexual, you know, identity afterwards. And this, and like, listen, like, I'm a happily in love gay man. I'm not saying that like all gay, like, or I don't want to use the word gay. I am in love with a man and I am a man. So I'm going to try not to like identify as anything. I just happen to be someone in love with a man. I don't think it's impossible to have a healthy relationship in that way. But I do think the government like fucks with people to create, yeah, I mean, to like create these like weird gender and sexual identities.
100%. No, yeah. They definitely do. I 100% agree. But I also thought it was interesting, the Harley Pasternak connection to area, and just like how he is such a presence in LA. And also he says in Toronto, I guess he used to say on his like whatever LinkedIn bio. I just think that, and there's a lot of celebrities like Meghan Markle lived for a time in Toronto. Like right near the U of T. She lived in Yorkville, like where it's like a more bougier area. It's like where they have like the nicer hotels and stuff. And like,
explain, Jen, who Harley Pasternak is for those who may not know. Or
okay. Well, he was Kanye's trainer who threatened him with basically like a 401 hold, I guess, like an involuntary hold. For basically questioning the narrative. Now, how much of the Kanye stuff is real or not real, I don't know. I do know that Kanye is clearly like a magician in the same way that Jay-Z is a magician. That
wasn't, you know, he also like Ellen Page's trainer?
Yes, and a lot of people, a lot of people who had mental breakdowns, a lot of people who overdosed, a lot of people whose careers kind of like, I don't know, like had really like didn't end that great, we'll say, or that like, you know, that it was he did seem like a handler, like if you look at the roster, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I mean, he worked, as you're discussing now, he got his PhD, I think, in Toronto. And he then worked for the Canadian military in some like weird MK Ultra-ish research thing. And there's actually a really fucked up, but I mean, fascinating clip of him talking about, just like candidly speaking about like the type of research he did. Mm-hmm. And I might insert it here if I can find it. Yeah, it's crazy. And then, yeah, like he came into the news during this recent Kanye thing with, I think it was when he was like ranting about the Jews or whatever. And then they were trying to shut him up. And then Kanye like either tweeted or posted on Instagram or something, some screenshots of text messages from Harley Pasternak. And it was not something that you would think of like a typical personal trainer would be sending about, like, basically, we can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way, and you'll be so drugged out, you won't be able to think and you won't get to see your kids again. You'll be locked up in an institution.
Yeah, it was crazy shit.
Yeah.
Maybe I need him to be my trainer.
I don't think you want him to be your trainer.
I just want the drug part. But, but yeah, I mean... And it's interesting because they keep, like, I'm a huge horror movie fan. I know, like, to some extent you are too, Jen. And, like, I actually just saw Immaculate today with Sydney Sweeney, and just FYI listeners, those titties do be out. that's not even that exciting because you can see her titties everywhere now. But anyway, like I was just thinking about how they're never going to give up like the serial killer horror movie. You know what I mean? Like even the new X movie, which is T-West, is all about the Night Stalker. You know, and like I almost think that like these serial killers are in some ways like foundational American myths. Like, you know, even though they're all in the 20th century, like they're really based on this idea of the highway system, right? Like the freedom of the car, the ability of these people, you know, Ted Bundy, like all these people, they talk about how like they were able to move from city to city because of like the kind of freedom of the American like car and like car culture. And that's very like West, it's very like out in the West. And I think that in some ways, like these serial killer stories have become foundational American myths in the exact same way as like the civil rights movement is, or even as far back as like fucking like the founding fathers are, or like Pocahontas is. Like the new America, the America that was created like post 1960s, serial killers are definitely part of that kind of like foundational myth of like the recreated America that happened, you know, post World War II.
I totally agree with you. I've actually heard you say this, Q, and I always found it incredibly insightful. I will say that I do think they're bringing back the serial killer. I think they're bringing it back because they're making more of them. I don't think that any serial killer is organic. That's just my opinion. That's just my opinion. But I don't think they are like a self-arising phenomenon.
No, they're definitely not. I mean, we're going to do an episode like later on about like maybe how they moved from the serial killer to like the spree killer or to like the mass shooter. But I do think they're going to bring back kind of like a serial killer. I think it's already starting. Like there's going to be like a new wave of like kind of ritualistic like serial killer mania. And
well, there already is, if you consider like the smiley face.
It's so funny how like in sync we are, because I was about to bring up smiley face, because they're already, I don't know if you know about this, but there's like all these young men, like young virile, like mostly white, like, you know, 20 something men who have been found drowned in various like canals and stuff, and the explanation was always like, oh, they just were drunk and fell in the canal or whatever. But now people have been doing a pretty good job of like connecting, like the circumstances are always like almost exactly the same. They don't really point to accidental drowning, and they're finding all these spray painted smiley faces near the sites of these young men's death. So it's like there's already kind of like percolating myths like that of like, you know, new serial killer lore beginning to kind of happen.
Yeah. And I should just shout out, because I am associated with that show, is that Nick from Occult Rejects has been doing a great job on like doing breakdowns of the Austin smiley face killer. And William Ramsey obviously has been doing Riley Strain in Nashville. So yeah, if people are more interested in that, they should definitely go and check out that all their work. They've been done like, oh, they also have done tons of work on the Idaho 4 and that like whole thing, and that's very strange as well.
Well, that was definitely like a massive op. Like what happened? So like for like the listeners who don't know, like in Idaho there was a insane like killing and inside of this house that a bunch of basically teenagers were living in college. Two of the teenagers survived and heard nothing, and four other ones were murdered, brutally murdered, like to the point where there would have been no way, there wouldn't have been like horrific sounds, you know. And the guy they caught, it just doesn't make any sense. It just seems like he's a total patsy. So yeah, I agree, Jen. They're beginning to they're beginning to like kind of do the serial killer thing. And another one I want to bring in is, I think Gabby Petito was also kind of another like, we're kind of doing the serial killer thing again. Yeah. Even though it wasn't a serial murder, there was definitely like kind of a mass Gabby Petito hysteria thing. And I'm not even 100% convinced that the Gabby Petito video is not a total deep fake, which really freaks me out. But if you rewatch it, I would encourage anyone who's into this stuff to rewatch it. Like, I'm not even 100% sure that that video is not AI. Like, you know, so.
No, I totally agree. That was a great, that was great. I agree with you actually on the Gabby Petito thing. I never really bought into that. I had no idea who she was. I didn't follow the case, but I agree with you. There's something that felt really off about it. There's something that feels off about all of these things. And once you kind of...
They never found the boyfriend's body, and the police's excuse was he was eaten by alligators.
Or a python.
Yeah, it was like everything about it was so weird. It was like none of it made any sense.
Well, and that's a different flavor of the whole thing too, that's been on like the white girl of the week kind of thing. They used to have like the Natalie Holloway, you know.
That was a really weird case too, though.
Yeah, oh yeah, no, for sure. The Joran Vandersnoot guy or whatever the fuck. Yeah. He was like an intelligence asset or something.
Oh, 100%.
Oh, I mean 100%. Like when 100%. You read about all the stuff he got away with for like years and years. He like gets away with Natalie, and next thing you know, he's like selling like 13-year-old Thai girls to like men in Germany. Like it makes no and he like never goes to jail. It makes no sense.
No, 100%. That's
and now they're doing like, I mean, like there's even more weird ops going on, because now it's like we're gonna do P. Diddy's the new Epstein. It's like there's this whole like apparatus.
Poor Cassie.
That's who's all Cassie?
You know, the singer. Did from he like the first? Early 2000s. She only had the one song that you'd know. No, she was his girlfriend. She was like his girlfriend for like 14 years. Oh. And they would do these like freakathons. And he would like pump her full of drugs and fly in all these like, I don't know, like big black eye prosies. And like he would watch as they like gangbanged her basically. Pretty horrible, actually.
You know, no one ever... That's awful. No one ever laughed at my tweets about how we never talk about how J-Lo shot up that club. But I feel like we're going to be... I feel like J-Lo knows the gig is up. That's why she's doing all this, like, weird, weird movie release stuff. Mm-hmm. Because, like... You know, there's some shit on that bitch. She was with P. Diddy at the beginning. So, but I don't know. I mean, like, it's so hard to put it all into a picture, because, like, I think the overall picture is just like, be scared, be fearful. Your kids could get shot at school. You could get raped on the street. A serial killer could kill you. Like, it's just like the whole thing is just like, it's just like this endless, like, kind of, you know, cycle of like, you should be scared. I think
I agree. I agree.
And then even as a horror movie buff, I do agree with A on this one front, because I know like A's wife is also into horror movies too. And it's like we're all sort of obsessed with being scared, and they keep just like pumping out content that we're like, mostly women are watching.
Like the only genre of content now is like true crime and horror movies. Like that's it. Or horror miniseries.
It is true. And it's like all anyone watches, the target audience is definitely women, who are the more emotional and like, you know, the more emotional sex. And it's like, everyone's just like hitting their little vape pens, listening to like horrific serial killer podcasts, just like on their SSRIs, just like, and I'm describing like myself right now. And they're just like getting more and more and more like anxious, you know? So
One thing I do find really interesting, and I am not a true crime person. Like Nick has asked me to do a true crime series, and I said no. because I don't like that shit. Like, I really don't. I stay away from it, really. I was even surprised that I, like, offered up this topic for you, but I actually thought it was interesting because I know Toronto so well as, like, a physical geography. And, like, a lot of people, like, it's not New York, right? It's not a San Francisco. It's not really an iconic city. So I just think it's an interesting sort of layout for people who are, like, really from there, not from somewhere else, which is a lot of what Toronto is, but just like New York, I guess. But, like, I'm really from Toronto, so I just thought that's interesting. But I will say, when I've listened to, like, Nick or whomever do work on it, they will really go, like, he really goes in depth on the sort of magical and occult aspects, because he was in the OTO for quite a few years, over a decade. So he knows a lot of, like, the ritual and ceremonial magical, like, Golden Dawn texts that I never knew, right?
Because what's the OTO? Because I just want to make sure I'm under. I'm acronym deaf, so I need to.
That's no, like, that's okay. Aleister Crowley.
Group, oh, right? Okay.
Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's right. It's the So it's like the Telema, basically the Telema
rule. Right. So right.
So all the killings are associated. They have a lot of magic things built into them. There's always, like, animals found. I hate that shit. Like, I think that's sicko. Like, don't play with animals or kids. Like, you know. But anyways, they all have all this magic shit, and, like, even some of the ways that the victims narrate the stories, like, they do sometimes sound like it's not fully real. Like, there's things that sound like a way that you code magical experiences in the way that you tell it. So you might tell a story of, like, oh, you're this thing, but maybe you're telling, and you're not lying. I'm not saying they're lying. I'm saying that they're coding what they're saying in something else. So I just think that there is something there, like, there's something very esoteric about it.
Can I bring up something weird that I just wanted the listeners to know about? And it's actually hitting the news right now. So apparently Ivy Getty is getting divorced. But did you guys, and it just got filed, like, it just hit the news, like, 40 minutes ago, but I don't know if anyone remembers her wedding, and in lieu of gifts, she asked people to donate to a organization that's run by the Process Church.
Oh, interesting.
That is really interesting. And she's 29 years old.
Yeah, she's super young, and I'm just, and the fact that she's getting divorced so quickly after the wedding kind of makes me feel, like, even more convinced it was just a crazy fucking ritual.
Yeah, well, and they did that, they had the whole Travis Scott thing was the same weekend.
Yeah, the Travis, we did this, the Travis Scott thing was the same weekend, Nancy Pelosi officiated. And just everything about the wedding was so demonic and weird. So just the fact they're getting divorced so fast, I'm just kind of like, it makes it even more certain to me that it was, that it was, like,
they did a whole satanic murder ritual and the marriage only lasts 2 years.
That's, I know.
Bullshit. Yeah. I mean, I actually listened to that episode. I thought you guys did a great job. I don't really know celebrity culture things at all. But I do know the Travis Scott thing because he is, like, connected to the Jay-Z, like, Nuwabian sort of, like, black Kemeticist, black sorcerer cults or whatever it is. And yeah, it's really crazy. And I just, in the whole astro world, like, I can't even get over that. And his t-shirt and crossing the abyss and just, like, I mean, it was just, like, pure, like, it was like Telema 101, really. It was, like, just, like, the perfect set. I'm not even blaming Telema. I'm saying that the whole situation was, like, a perfect ritual to do something. Like, if you were going to do something, that was, like, exactly how to set it up. So, and, like, the wedding, I agree. And then 29, so that's 11. Just, that's really strange that she's, like, it's all magic numbers with them, right? Like, the richer you are, the more the numbers align in a weird way, or maybe you just set things up so the numbers align.
So what do you mean when you say 29, that's 11?
Well, she's 29, so mm-hmm. obviously, in if you were doing like a numerology of her,
oh, like age, 2 + 9,
yeah, 2 + 9, so mm-hmm. 11 is like the magic number. It's the number that is, it's kind of like the number contrary to God. That's kind of the idea. There's 10 spheres of the Kabbalah tree, so there's 10 sephirah, but then there's also an 11th secret sphere, Dath, which every magician knows is the abyss. That's what they always say. It's not really, but it is. That is how magicians often think of it. So the 11th sphere is the sphere of magic. It's calling the lightning strike of God down to the kingdom, down to the physical manifestation. So you're really not supposed to do that. You're supposed to ride the lightning upwards. You're supposed to go to God, right? That's the whole idea. But if you do 11 is kind of that thing where you're putting something into material creation. You're putting your will into material creation. So I just think that that's really interesting that she, you know, I don't think anything's a coincidence. This is my personal opinion. I don't think that they set things up to be, I think they set things up to either be numerological or they're following some kind of astrological prescriptions. And like the more you do rituals and the more you do magic, the more the numbers will align for you. That also happens. So the more tapped in you are, the more the numbers will start happening. But then you're also playing the numbers at the same time. So there becomes like this space where you're like 1 foot in, 1 foot out. And you're not sure whether it's the numbers happening for you or are you just like so good at them that it's like you're just setting it up and it's just like synchro mystical.
So Talima and like there's other offshoots of the similar kind of things, but this is like what like Jack Parsons and people like that was that also related to this kind of stuff?
Oh, 100%. And like the whole Jack Parsons thing is so tied into Process Church, is so tied into Scientology. I mean, we want to say that there's like this like crazy satanic organization. I mean, that's what Scientology is, 100%. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's intelligence-backed, intelligence-funded, intelligence-founded. And it has its tendrils into everything. And it has all these like, sort of like its origin story really developed out of like this thing with Crowley, who was MI6, mm-hmm. Parsons, who was actually going to take a job with in Israel, working at Tel Aviv mm-hmm. University. So I'm not saying he was Mossad. I'm saying that he was going to take a job there. So perhaps he was American intelligence, or
he was involved with NASA, right?
Right. So he would have to have had clearance, security clearance. And then you have Elrond, who was in the OSS. Mm-hmm. So you have this like sort of nexus of these like multiple intelligence agencies in ritual magic doing really sicko shit. I'm not saying that everything that they talked about they did. I don't think that. I think that a lot of the sicko shit they talked about is actually just magic coding. Because mm-hmm. that is like something you do. It is like you can say, oh, they did this transgressive thing or this transgressive thing. But only the people who don't know better get stuck on those external transgressions. If you know better, then you know that it's just a code. It's just like a cipher that you have to figure out what they were really up to or what they were really saying.
Interesting. And so what is the connection? And I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I'm personally curious, what is the relationship between all of these sort of occult movements and Freemasonry?
Okay. So I have spoken to several people on my show who are deep, like researchers into Freemasonry, but sorry about that. So it's not my particular specialty. But okay. I do understand something. So I'll say, like, this might be not a totally correct history, but I will give you like a quick rundown. So basically, the Illuminists, the Rosicrucians, the Jesuits, the Templars, a group of rabbis, the Temple Society, whatever, they all, well, so, okay, this is, I'll just give you my gin sort of explanation, because I think it'll still be better than me trying to, like, re-narrate a history that I don't really totally understand. So, basically, Freemasonry uses the tree. So, every religion has this idea of the tree, the perennial sort of tree, the Kabbalah tree, if you want to say it like that. But it's really based on something older, on something Persian. And all the religions, every single religion has it. Every, like, the Orthodox cross with the, you know, it has the little line at the bottom and, like, the, it's not quite the same. And, but even the Catholic crucifix, like, if you look at a Catholic crucifix and you apply it to, like, a Kabbalah, like a Hebrew tree, it's exactly what you would think it would be. Like, it fits exactly on the Sephirah that would make sense for Catholicism. And then also the Orthodox cross fits exactly where the sort of theology, soteriology of Orthodoxy would place emphasis. So Buddhism also has this idea of the tree. So I think we're just looking at a perennial system. And then Freemasonry, there's two different kinds. Obviously, there's Scottish Rite, and then there's the French continental sort of Illuminist Rite. They sometimes would transpose the blue and the red. So it's not necessarily the same. Like when you're talking about left and right, you're not necessarily talking about the same left and right. That's like in Canada, like where our liberal party, so our like leftish party is red and our conservative-ish party is blue.
Oh,
so that's like, so every country sort of has a different Freemason tree that they use, or whatever kind of tree it is. So the whole idea in like this kind of like global homo is to unify all the countries to use the same tree. So everyone's like, the way they do like dialectical alchemy and like do, you know, like do culture creation, cultural management, like play both sides, like they're the puppet masters of both sides. So they bring everything into dialectical synthesis under their control, obviously, but they can't do that if the trees are different. So I think the real idea is to bring all the trees into unity, but not, you know, there's going to be factional infighting. So I think that's partly why they haven't fully achieved that. So Freemasons are part of it, obviously. However, I'm sort of open to this idea that maybe there are good, not good Freemasons currently, but maybe in historical context, there was Illuminist Freemasons who really wanted to liberate humanity from this kind of like dialectical struggle sessions, maybe. And so they were like, we're going to do a system that is much more difficult to control. So maybe the US is like the best example, like the origin of the US. And then they were successful for a time. And then obviously these like external forces, like maybe we'll say like the Anglo-Dutch establishment comes in sort of like, we're going to do it using like the tree, whatever tree they use here, they're going to like manipulate it. So I think that is a lot of what's happening. And then a lot of people are like, Crowley was interesting in some ways because he was more Luciferian. And what I mean by that is he wanted to sort of liberate these secret doctrines from, you know, from like the secret societies. That's what he said anyway, and give them to the masses. But the problem with that is that the masses aren't necessarily ready. It's not that they can't, it's not that you should have these secret societies or whatever. I'm not in favor of that, but I'm just saying, I just know in Tantra, like you don't give like an advanced practice to someone who's like just walked in the door. Like they're not going to be able to do it. They're not going to understand it. And they're not, and like, you're just going to give them hardship. So that's kind of what magic is. It's kind of like this thing. If you don't really know what the fuck you're doing, you can really fuck up your life. Like it's like drugs almost. That's basically what it is. So, you know, you have to balance all these things. It can't just be like, oh, we're going to do like a data dump of magic onto like mass society. No, you're going to get chaos. And then there are those people who love chaos.
Yeah.
So they kind of feed off of chaos.
Well, and that, I mean, there's this whole idea that if like with, I am aware of it in the context of Freemasonry, but I imagine that it applies in some way to many of these different factions. But the idea of processing people, you know, that's sort of the alchemy that's at play. And that's what a lot of these I guess psyops or whatever, for lack of a better word, in some sense are a spell of some kind or an attempt to initiate, you know, the public into these kind of occult practices or whatever.
Yeah, 100%. It's to see who makes it past the beginning. It's to see, because, you know, like the Freemason symbol is like the black and white checkerboard floor with the three pillars. So you've got like the two pillars, the red and the blue. Then you have the secret third thing, which is the secret pillar with Sirius, the star Sirius, on the top. Mm-hmm. Basically, it is to see who makes it past the checkerboard floor. That is the idea. But then there's also the idea that you can't really move past it if you are not appropriately of the sort of right background. So I do think that that is also at play. Like, I think we often forget about that, because I think, like, I know a lot of people love Bill Cooper and like those like older conspiracy guys who came before, but they had a lot of flaws in their work, because I think that they sort of muddied the waters, because they said a lot of true things, but then they also said a lot of bullshit. Mm-hmm. And I think that that muddies the waters. So then we forget, it tends to emphasize the things that don't matter as much. And then we forget about the more important things, like who really are the people behind this? Like, who really are they? And a lot of people will say, oh, it's the Jays or whatever. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, I'm not, that's not my particular orientation at all, because I just think my experience with medieval Kabbalah has been very positive. And everyone who I've spoken to who's practiced it seriously, I've respected afterwards. Like, I've honestly come away with being like, yes, they're like, they have some kind of great intellectual insight into like the nature of God and the nature of reality. So how can you, like, if it's not evil, as long as you don't direct it to be evil, it's not going to be evil. That's sort of how I think. So I just think that sometimes people get stuck on like these like externalities, but I think that the reality is they're all related. They're clearly all related, and they're clearly like, I more think they're Anglo-Dutch, but I do think that it's not just that. I think that's a more limited way to look at it. Like I'm saying, like, I don't think it's just like a superficial demographic that we can like identify. Mm-hmm. I think it's something much more esoteric, maybe spiritual. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with it. Like, I just think that we need to look at the who really, what is really going on. I think sometimes I know that when they were talking about like the WEF stuff and all that, when that was happening, mm-hmm. that was really interesting. And a lot of people were like very like awakened by that kind of discourse for the first time. But I also think it was very limited, because that was like just a middle management group in some ways.
Yeah. Sort of a misdirection.
Exactly. Exactly.
Magic, as it were.
Yeah, it was. That's what magic is.
But so I think one thing I wanted to ask you that I just forgot about, but maybe this is a good thing to close on with you. But so I listened to your appearance on Ball Earth Propaganda. Shout out to those guys. And one thing that I thought was interesting that you talked about is, I think you described it as like the difference between illusion and delusion, and that kind of the skill that people need to learn most at this juncture is how to discern between the two. Do you have any, I was curious just if you had any more, like wanted to expand on that point. Sure. Or if I misstated it or anything.
No, like that, you said it. That was great. So I did say that actually. And I commend myself for saying that, because it sounds rather intelligent. So there is this idea of Maya. So Maya is both the beauty of the world and the illusion of the world, but it's not negative. The illusion just means that it's the superficial perception. So like the things that we see, the light So when it's like you wake up in the morning, it's just the sun is just rising. It's breaking through the clouds and you're looking over a beautiful park. Okay. That's Maya. But then there's this other thing, which is Mara. So Mara is like a demoness, but it lives in your mind. So yes, there are obviously supernatural things that I believe in, but really it comes down to consciousness. So then there's this other thing that, even Catholicism has this idea of degradation of consciousness and illumination of consciousness as well, especially with Mary. So I just think that Mara really is this thing. It's the lies we tell ourselves. It's the lies we tell ourselves about ourselves and the lies that we tell ourselves to get us through the day. It doesn't necessarily mean that we know we're telling a lie but it's like what Q was saying about identity. That is a lie that we tell ourselves about ourselves. So that would be like a Mara. That would be like a kind of a delusion of the world, like how we position ourselves in it. But doesn't really mean anything. It's just like a superficial sort of like ideological category that doesn't really exist in a material way. So in my opinion, the best way to like sort of emphasize this practice of discernment or the ability maybe to be discerning in the world is through more rigorous spiritual exercises. I call them often, we'll refer to them as thurgical, meaning that you are not doing low magic, you are not doing manifestation, you're not doing astrology, but you are not maybe learning those things in order to apply them to higher acts of like, not invocation or anything, but you're sort of refining, if you want to say soul, or refining yourself, if you believe in a static self, you're refining it so you can be a vessel for God. So like even the way we spoke about at the very beginning about like a high guardian angel ritual, the whole purpose is to like come face to face with at least a shard of the divine, maybe not directly God, but some people have had that experience. So I think that those are useful practices if applied correctly. And what they help do is they help build. Knowledge is created in synthesis. It's created in understanding, text, meaning text, and experience. So practice. So once you do those things, you sort of gain knowledge and you understand how to apply the practices to do greater works. And so I think that when we're engaging in those things, our capacity for discernment grows, and it's an infinite capacity. However, we can also get stuck in delusion when the negative things arise in our life. They may not necessarily be related to our practice, but usually people who are undertaking more rigorous spiritual practices, they do have certain demons or certain like vices or certain sins or lusts or desires will arise, because that's part of the spiritual process as well. So being able to discern those are just things that are there to tempt us or there to sort of move us off the path of whatever we're doing, we have to be able to discern that and push through that. So that's kind of where I'm at with it. I hope that answered your question, like in a decent way, not super esoteric, but this, you know, that is who I really am. It's not just a character I play. That is who I really am. That's how I really think of the world. That's how I interact with the world. So it's hard for me to use other terms, but I am trying.
No, that was great. That was great. And just more food for thought. And I think that's something that's kind of the question for me since awakening, or whatever you want to call it. I know it's a complicated, it's a process, not just a singular event. So, but learning how to discern between those two things. And it's difficult. So
it's a challenge, and you have to not give up. That's the real key. If there's like any key to magic or any key to doing ritual practices, it's that you cannot give up, because you're going to fuck up your life more if you go halfway. So you're either going to go all the way or you're not going, or don't go at all. That's basically what it is.
I think that's
and don't watch movies. That's my pre 2012. Don't watch movies pre 2012.
Yeah, yeah. That's what my rule is. Like I'm anything post 9/11. I can't.
I agree with that.
Watching. So yeah.
Yeah, they're all evil. They're all just trying to. I'm sure I'm like really put something bad into my spirit from watching Immaculate today.
It's fine. It's fine. Q, you can be like, it's like Poolhouse said, you can be the world's greatest Christian Kabbalist. Well, I'll send you some Pico della Mirandola. Maybe you can get Greg Kaminsky on the show too, and he can talk about it. He's an expert on Pico. So,
yeah. Well, it was great having you on, Jen, and I appreciate you engaging in some of the esoteric talk, and I appreciate you geeking out with me about some of the serial killer MK Ultra stuff. So,
well, I appreciate both of you so much, and thank you for asking me on the show and tolerating me on Twitter and following me back, especially Q. I mean, A has followed me back since like the beginning, but Q, I had to charm you into doing it, so I appreciate it. And yeah, I love your guys' show, and I think you guys do something really special, and I appreciate that you asked me to be a part of it, so thank you.
Oh, thank you, it means a lot. And we love you too, listeners. Bye, homies and homos.